Today is Wednesday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. New York is screaming for help as the number of cases of the coronavirus surge.
One of the forecasters said to me, we were looking at a freight train coming across the country. We're now looking at a bullet train because the numbers are going up that quickly.
And virtual volunteers are offering help to strangers amid the virus stress. It's all on today's International Edition. And we begin with the latest on the global coronavirus pandemic. At least 400,000 people worldwide have been infected, and over 18,000 have died, according to a running count kept by Johns Hopkins University. India, with its 1.3 billion people, or one-sixth of the Earth's population, has now ordered the biggest lockdown in the world. As virus deaths continue to accelerate here in the U.S., President Donald Trump says he's aiming to reopen the country in weeks, not months. But with more than 50,000 Americans to have confirmed cases and at least 600 deaths so far, public health experts warn that could be a big mistake. AP White House correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president's complained the current 15-day shutdown has battered a once-roaring economy.
I'd love to have it open by Easter.
Saying at a Fox News Channel virtual town hall, staying shut down could be worse than the virus itself.
You can destroy a country this way.
But many health officials say the nation will need stricter limits on public interactions to limit the virus's spread, and not looser ones. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says it's unacceptable that the president's suggesting economic losses and lifestyle changes are worse than American deaths.
Philadelphia will continue to do what is best for our residents.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
In New York City, with the most U.S. cases, authorities rushed to set up thousands of hospital beds for potential victims. But the number of cases is doubling every 3 days, threatening to swamp the city's intensive care units in the weeks ahead. Governor Andrew Cuomo said Tuesday the metropolitan area needs 30,000 ventilators and demanded that President Donald Trump use wartime authority to force manufacturers to produce them.
The increase in the number of cases continues unabated. As a matter of fact, the rate of increase has gone up.
New York State has already recorded more than 200 deaths, or one-third of the U.S. total. While Trump has invoked the Korean War era Defense Production Act to deter hoarding in crises like this, but he so far has been reluctant to use it to force companies to produce medical supplies. Joining us to talk more about the situation in the U.S. and in New York is Dr. Aaron Glatt, chair of the Department of Medicine, chief of infectious diseases in the Department of Epidemiology at Mount Sinai Nassau Hospital in New York. Before we get into the issues facing the supply shortages and the situation across the U.S. and New York, what's your reaction to the president saying that he's going to open the country back up, possibly on Easter?
It's very, very difficult to predict what's going to happen in the future. And I think that we need to take every day one step at a time. And at this point in time, the message has not gotten out adequately yet to the population. The extreme social distancing is the only way we're going to get a handle on this pandemic. And in places in the United States where this has hit especially hard, such as New York and in other parts of the country as well, but I'll talk about my experience in New York. This is a disaster. Every hospital is already feeling overwhelmed, and every hospital is essentially 100% full-time working on COVID patients and trying to also take care of all the other patients as well. We've stopped almost anything that's elective. We've stopped anything that can be pushed off. We've diverted all of our resources into creating new areas and creating additional intensive care beds, creating special COVID units. If the population doesn't understand how critical this is and they keep on mingling, keep on having public gatherings, even in the beaches, outdoors, but they're close to each other and they're coming into physical contact with numerous people, this will spread further. It will get worse. It will not get better. And I'm not a prophet, but medical evidence that's happened in Italy, the medical evidence happened in in Seattle and Washington. Evidence across other countries in the world suggests that we're going to be in a tremendous amount of difficulty if we don't drastically change the way we're doing business today, and essentially limiting any contact within 6 feet of anybody else that's not absolutely essential.
You mentioned Italy. There are experts that are saying that the U.S. could very easily overtake Italy as the epicenter, and they've already had record highs there, including, last count I heard, it was close to 24 doctors that died.
This is very tragic, and the most important thing that we need to do to protect our infrastructure is to make sure that there is adequate and no shortages of the essential personal protective equipment that physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, all the hospital workers must have, environmental health workers who walk into these rooms and clean them. These are essentials if we're going to maintain a healthcare system here and put our healthcare staff online and on risk, then we have to make sure as a country, as a commitment, that there are adequate masks, adequate face shields, adequate ventilators, adequate equipment for them to do the job. They're walking into a lion's den. They're going and doing their jobs, potentially personal risk to themselves and their families. And in my experience, they're doing it unflinchingly. And yet at the same time, it's critically important that the supply chain be improved and increased to make sure that they don't have to worry, am I doing the right thing? Am I not doing the right thing?
We've been talking about this since January, getting the supplies to our health professionals. Why is it taking so long? We hear New York's governor talking about, you know, turning the Javits Center into basically another hospital, but he was basically pleading for respirators, not hundreds, but thousands.
The number of respirators in New York that we have right now, where everybody is trying very desperately to increase the number of respirators and trying to purchase them and trying to utilize every possible mechanism. Even with all of that, we're going to be dramatically short, potentially, of the number of respirators that we're going to need. This is a priority. If we're in a situation where we have a person who could theoretically be saved by being put on a respirator and we don't have that respirator for them, then that's a tragedy.
What are we learning about this virus as far as its contagion? Because it seems much worse than we even heard in the beginning about how contagious it is.
And we're learning more every day. And as information comes out, we can put it into practical utilization. I always like to point out the good things. I always try to be an optimist as possible. While children can be carriers and maybe potential transmitters, at least, thank God, children seem to be almost universally exempt from horrific outcomes. There has, thank God, not to date been a single death in a child under 10 years of age. Little kids, they seem to get a mild cold, and they don't really get very sick. Unfortunately, they can transmit it to their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and that's a disaster.
Right.
But at least, thank God, little kids don't seem to get very sick. That's at least a little silver lining in the cloud that I think people need to take some comfort in, especially parents who are very, very worried. But unfortunately, we have seen that the potential for people who are older and the potential for people with underlying illnesses to get sicker than other people is there. And that has been exactly what the world has seen in the original cases in China, in Wuhan and Hubei, and what we're seeing in Italy. Older patients, and again, every decade that you go up, certainly above 50, but even below 50, we're seeing people that are unfortunately sometimes very sick. You're increasing the morbidity and the mortality, how sick people get, and heaven forbid, unfortunately, having even a fatal outcome. So it's critically important, especially for older people. They absolutely, everybody has to do this, but they have to absolutely minimize their going out. Their children should try to shop for them if possible and drop off the food at grandpa's house, grandma's house, and not have anybody come in. And they really need to isolate themselves to a certain extent. They can FaceTime, they can WhatsApp, they can do any sort of technology to keep in touch. Absolutely, that's critical. But older people are especially at risk from this. And if they're going to go about business as usual, it's going to be tragic.
That was Dr. Aaron Glatt, chair of the Department of Medicine, chief of infectious diseases in the Department of Epidemiology at Mount Sinai Nasa Hospital in New York. In Italy, a glimmer of hope that it might be turning the corner faded after officials reported an increase in new cases and deaths. Spain, meanwhile, registered a record one-day increase of nearly 6,600 new infections and a leap of more than 500 in the death toll to almost 2,700. The country started storing bodies in an ice rink converted to a morgue until they could be buried or cremated. The International Olympic Committee postponed the 2020 Tokyo Olympics until the summer of 2021 at the latest, acting on the recommendation of Japan's prime minister. That could be a heavy economic blow to Japan and could upset athletes' training regimens, perhaps costing some of them a shot at a medal. Still, the decision was met with relief from some competitors. And as some experts are not ruling out a downturn in the United States that rivals the magnitude of the 1930s depression, stocks soared on Tuesday as lawmakers closed in on a nearly $2 trillion deal to blunt the outbreak's economic damage. Well, after a late start, coronavirus is also spreading across Africa, with several countries, notably South Africa, Senegal, and Cote d'Ivoire, ramping up their responses this week, declaring curfews and or states of emergency. But experts say the continent's fragile health system will likely be hard hit, and previous health crises, notably Ebola, do not necessarily carry translatable lessons for this one. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
South Africa, Senegal, and Ivory Coast are among the latest African countries to announce new steps to contain COVID-19, including threats of heavy fines for violators. Here insert Ouattara announcing measures fade under. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara declared a state of emergency on Monday and tightened restrictions, including imposing a dusk-to-dawn curfew. Here insert Macky Sall Act in French fade under. The same message from Senegal's President Macky Sall. Both leaders have also earmarked funds to help their populations and health workers battle the virus. Coronavirus cases have been reported in more than 40 African countries to date, with South Africa the hardest hit. The numbers are still a fraction of those in Asia, Europe, or the United States, but experts fear that could change. Fragile health systems, poverty, population density in big cities, and insecurity could turn a major health problem into a catastrophe. Last week, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned the continent must wake up to the coronavirus threat. Here insert a Tedros Act in English. It begins with the best advice and ends with prepare today. And Act, and here insert Mendiarat Act in English. It begins with the situation and ends with some countries. And Act, begin text. Pierre Mendiarat is Deputy Director of Operations for humanitarian group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. He says one of Africa's advantages is timing. The region is behind other places like China or Italy on the coronavirus trajectory. Here insert Mendiarat Act. It begins with even in the worst case scenario and ends with more resources. And Act, begin text. Which means African nations might be able to tap health supplies, like masks and oxygen machines, from countries where the pandemic has subsided, and take advantage of possible research advances, like rapid testing and experimental treatments. African nations that weathered the Ebola outbreak might have an extra advantage, although experts note COVID-19 is far more contagious. Here insert Mendiarat Act 3. It begins with, I think, the health authorities, and ends with hand washing. And Act, begin text. So tough measures to slow coronavirus and to buy time to better fight it may be the best strategy for Africa right now. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A 42-year-old Mexican man died in a South Texas hospital while being held pending his deportation. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said he died Saturday after being hospitalized Thursday. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, immigration advocates have criticized the medical care ICE is providing to people it detains and called on it to release some of the more than 37,000 detainees. Meanwhile, as the U.S. announced it will close its border with Mexico and Canada and essentially push back on people who lack documentation, including asylum seekers and unaccompanied children, Amnesty International has called these restrictions cruel and short-sighted for those who are most vulnerable. Joining us now to talk more about it is Sharnia Krishnaswamy, America's Advocacy Director for Amnesty International USA.
There were a pair of orders that were handed down on Friday, March 20th. Mm-hmm. The first was a border closure with Mexico and the U.S., basically shutting the border to all quote, non-essential travel, but still preserving the right to essential travel. And then there was a separate order issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, basically suggesting that anybody who lacks valid documentation would be immediately sent back without any kind of a process. And so that's the order that implicates the rights of asylum seekers.
What is Amnesty's position on this? I know that it's very concerned about it. Tell me what your concerns are and why.
So we're really concerned because even in times of emergency, the right to asylum must be respected regardless. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, just put out guidelines to this effect just last week saying, you know, recognizing that we are in the middle of a public health crisis, but that is not a justification to dispense with our international and domestic legal obligations towards asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And it is possible to both respond to this public health crisis we're collectively living in while respecting the rights of asylum seekers. What's interesting and what's concerning is that the CDC cited in its order the existence of these open-air tent camps where refugees are currently living right along the Mexico-U.S. border, and saying that those are justification to shut down the right to asylum altogether. But the reason those camps exist is because the U.S. has restricted the right to asylum so much. It's sent people to live in these dangerous, tenuous conditions in Mexico. And that's why they've had to congregate in these open-air encampments. So if anything, restricting the right to asylum is only going to worsen our collective public health.
If we don't even have enough healthcare facilities for American citizens, and this thing is continuing to spread like wildfire, and people aren't allowed to go out of their houses, how can we say that this isn't going to potentially cause this to spread if people are coming into the country without the ability to test them and without a facility to house them in?
What appears to cause rapid transmission is a congregate sort of enclosure of these individuals in detention facilities, in border facilities, in these open-air encampments. And the policies that the U.S. is pursuing actually exacerbate those risks. So one call we have out to the U.S. government, which has been echoed by everybody from the former acting ICE director himself all the way to a chorus of rights groups, is that immigrants in detention facilities in the United States must immediately be released. They need to stop holding these immigration court hearings that also hold people in these congregate settings that can facilitate rapid transmission. But the U.S. isn't pursuing any of those policies that we know would slow the spread. Instead, what they're doing is pursuing a border closure, which, if anything, is likely to exacerbate the spread for the reasons I just shared, because these folks are potentially going to be pushed back to these same dangerous encampments in Mexico, where spread is imminent and will be absolutely devastating. As to your question about how we can handle this, given the lack of resources, lack of testing capabilities, that sort of a thing, Canada, before it sadly reversed course, initially had put into place a plan that that would have done both, that would have respected the right to asylum and our collective public health by providing for, you know, rapid screening, quarantining for individuals who were at risk of exhibiting symptoms or were at risk of transmission for 14 days. So it is possible to implement these measures that would preserve our public health.
The measures they are implementing, when do they go into effect, and is this temporary or permanent, as far as the administration is saying?
So this is the grave fear. President Trump made this offhand comment saying, you know, these measures will be in place through the pandemic and perhaps afterward. I'm paraphrasing. He said something along those lines. It's clear that he is weaponizing and manipulating this public health crisis to implement a measure he's long been after, you know, since January 2017.
That was Sharni Krishnaswamy, America's Advocacy Director for Amnesty International USA. Here are some of the other stories we're keeping an eye on at VOA. Malaysia's medical glove factories, which make up most of the world's critical hand protection, are operating at half capacity just when they're needed the most. Healthcare workers rely on the gloves as their first line of protection against catching COVID-19 from their patients, and they are crucial to protecting the patients as well. But the medical-grade glove supplies are running low globally, even as more feverish and coughing patients arrive in hospitals by the day. The U.S. State Department says it has managed to bring home over 9,000 Americans stranded in 28 countries after the global coronavirus all but closed many national borders and severely curtailed international flights. That is up from a total of over 5,000 from 17 countries just a day earlier. And with social distancing becoming an everyday practice, people around the globe are turning to technology to connect with others during the crisis. From meditation to yoga to psychotherapy, people are doing their part to offer free classes daily to help people recharge or feel connected. Other volunteers go online to provide relief of a different kind, offering strangers emergency money to deal with job loss or canceled events. Stay with VOA for all the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. Well, there are reports of chloroquine poisoning in the United States, Vietnam, and Nigeria among people who tried to self-medicate against COVID-19 using drugs containing the compound. At least two people have died, including a man in the U.S. state of Arizona, a hospital said, and a man in Vietnam's capital of Hanoi, according to a Vietnamese newspaper. The poisonings followed a claim by U.S. President Donald Trump last week that chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, both normally used to treat malaria, might treat COVID-19 too. Both drugs remain unproven as COVID-19 treatments. VOA's Jason Patinkin talked to Columbia University epidemiologist Dr. Elizabeth Radin about what current science actually says about using chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine against the COVID-19.
Both of these drugs have been shown to have some activity against the virus in vitro, which basically means in a test tube. So if we just chemically combine these agents with the virus in a glass tube or a petri dish, we can see some activity there. There was a study in China. That study was fairly small, kind of on the order of 100 people. And the findings were relatively preliminary because of that, that reported chloroquine treatment of COVID-19 related pneumonia. Those patients who were treated in that study were reported to have some clinical benefit, some limiting of their virus in comparison to the group that wasn't treated. And so chloroquine was recommended as a potential antiviral treatment in China. Based on this preliminary evidence, chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine are recommended for the treatment of hospitalized COVID patients in several countries. Now, there's caveats on that, and there's reasons that those are only recommended to be considered with patients who are already quite sick. There's no clinical trial evidence to inform dosing or duration for either prophylaxis or treatment of COVID-19. So really, overall, we're at a preliminary stage in evidence.
What is this process to approve a drug as a treatment? And then where along that line does chloroquine fall?
So there are three key steps. The first is testing the safety of the drug on a small scale, approximately tens of patients. The second is seeing if the drug that we now think we have evidence is at least safe is also effective at achieving the outcome we want. And that's done with approximately hundreds of patients. And the third step is testing both the safety and efficacy with a much larger sample that allows us to consider certain subpopulations, so younger people or older people or people with a certain pre-existing condition that allows us to consider potentially different dosages or even combinations with other drugs. And those studies are on the order of thousands of patients. We have not gotten all the way through that three-step process with chloroquine for the treatment of COVID-19. The trials are very much ongoing. We don't have the results yet.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Moon Gagne, I'm Lori London in Washington. Please take good care of yourselves and be well.
Saint-Tropez. I'm so sick of running as fast as I can. Wondering if I'd get there quicker if I was a man. And I'm so sick of them coming at me again. Cause if I was a man, then I'd be the man. I'd be the man. I'd be the man. What's it like to brag about raking in dollars and getting and models? And it's all good if you're bad, and it's okay if you're mad. Flashing my dollars, I'd be a not a bother. They paint me out to be bad, so it's okay that I'm mad. I'm so sick of running as fast as I can, wondering if I'd get there quicker if I was a man. You know that.
All you ever do is make me. VOA News via remote. I'm Michael.